everyone. This is Bill Knauer, and you are listening to Author, where one writer talks to another writer about the books we write and the lives we lead and how these two are one in the same. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the internet, featuring articles on writing and the writing life, as well as video and audio interviews with best-selling and award-winning authors across the genres. You can find Author Magazine at authormagazine.org. And we are funded by the Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. To learn more about the PNWA as well as their outstanding yearly writers conference, please go to pnwa.org. Well, you know, the reason in many ways that I am speaking to you right now on this lovely show is that about 6 or 7 years ago, I decided to look upon happiness, where it comes from, its source, I guess you could say, and its role in my life differently in many ways than I had been looking at it for most of my adult life. And that one little choice led to a series of changes, accelerated changes, that eventually led me to, among other places, Author Magazine, and to Author. And so I thought it entirely appropriate when I came across Andrea Pollard, my guest today, and her fascinating book, A Unified Theory of Happiness, An East Meets West Approach to Fully Loving Your Life. And so I thought, I've got to get this woman on my show, and now she is. Andrea, welcome to Author.
Thank you very much. I'm so happy to be here.
Well, let's begin with you. You describe yourself as a Zen psychologist. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So If for someone who doesn't know what a Zen psychologist is, how would you define that beyond those two words?
For me, it's a hybrid, living hybrid of Zen, Buddhism, and psychology. So in my practice, or in my being, even besides my clinical practice, I live by Zen Buddhism and by psychological insights and inquiry, without picking one over the other. So to me, usually people pick one and they emphasize one over the other and explain the one with the other. For me, I as a Western person and somebody who really loves psychology, I wanted to combine both of them in my living practice. And so that's what I do professionally, that's what I write about, and that's what I live.
And so you bring the sort of the Zen perspective to your psychology practice. You introduce that to your clients.
Yes, it's with me at all times. It's a, you know, Zen is difficult to explain, but for me, with words, and so easy to experience. Zen is really being in contact with the stream of life, experiencing life directly without any preconceived notions, without projections, without any ego infiltering the mind. So it's direct experience, and this direct experience for me, and being completely aware or trying to be in the present moment as much as I can, that is part of my every psychological practice, you know, with my clients. It's always with me. And so, yeah, the Zen perspective is being there, open-minded, listening, being really there for my client and making myself a part of this relationship, not looking down, you know, as I'm the expert and there's my little client, but really looking straight in the eye of another human being and making contact and meeting that person in the present moment and trying to observe that which is in the present moment.
Yes, and it's not always easy to do. It's very easy. I've talked from time to time on the show about, of course, I don't have clients. I have people I interview. But it's very easy for me as an interviewer to come in with my own preconceived notion of what this conversation will be. And inevitably, when I do that, it goes poorly. It's
yes.
like I've constructed a script to a play that they aren't that they had no knowledge of and they aren't following it. But when I release that and do, in many ways, what you're describing, just simply try to be present, it goes so much smoother and it's so much more alive. And I guess you could say it's so much more what it was actually intended to be. And it sounds like that's what you're doing in your work.
Yes, it's like the creative mind can only exist when you unblock your mind. And when you have so many projections and fears or anger or just expectations, anything that distracts from the present moment, yes, I do think that it blocks both the therapist and the client, or the, you know, the in your case the host and me in this case.
Yeah.
So we are much better off trying to be in the moment and not being attached to any particular outcome.
But you also enjoy the what would be more of the Western, what would be the sort of classically
mm-hmm.
Western, although I think honestly that's changing now as the world evolves. But
mm-hmm.
but the sort of class which is psychology, which I'm not a practicing psychologist, obviously, but it seems to me that engages, that calls upon your intellect in a more direct way than, say, than a Zen approach does.
Well, Zen is very intuitive, you're right, in that way. It's very spontaneous, it's listening, but it also draws upon skillful means. So the skillful means is also something known to Zen, and understanding a lot about Eastern philosophies does help as well in our direct experience. It's not it, it's not the direct experience, but it is definitely helpful. As a psychologist, I do pay very much attention to insights that we gain from science. I take them, you know, with a grain of salt. I really
mm-hmm.
look at them and see if they make common sense and if they can be integrated in something bigger. And I don't overly emphasize them as individual studies. But
okay.
I do pay attention, yes. And I do pay attention to changes in different approaches and different ways you can do with a client. And but, you know, in psychology, you also have to draw a lot on your intuition. I just read a fabulous book about this, Intuition, by Marx Tarlow. And she's amazing how she puts in the words that when you're a psychologist, you have a lot of information, you have a lot of knowledge in your head, hopefully. But when you are sitting with a client, what comes to mind is really what, you know, when something, when your right hemisphere of the brain, the creative part of the brain, that is active. When that is active, you can engage, and suddenly the right piece of information can emerge and can be linked up to what's actually happening in the moment. So there you have some commonalities as well.
You know, I always think that intuition, we look at, I guess there's this view of intuition as this sort of like magic little gift that lights upon you sometimes and sometimes it doesn't, sort of like inspiration. But because I work with my own imagination every day in my writing, and a form of creative writing is certainly intuitive, I feel like it's a muscle, really, that you can learn to train like any other muscle in terms of understanding it, trusting it, listening to it, hearing it, learning how to hear it, you know, behind the sort of noise of the mind. Have you found that to be the case?
In some ways, yes. In some ways, no. I feel like you can definitely enhance your intuition by removing lots and lots of obstacles in your mind, and by doing something creative, by practicing this, and by trying to relax. But, you know, for me, when I think of a muscle, I think of something you can willfully move. And I think intuition is more something you can willfully let come. There's a little difference. There's a little bit of less willpower involved and more attrition, like letting something go so that the good stuff can emerge between us and, within us. And I think then something can blossom inside of us and between people.
I agree completely. Yes, that's a great distinction. It's really the discipline, mm-hmm. so to speak, of letting go, mm-hmm. not of controlling, absolutely. And so unified theory of happiness. To some mm-hmm. degree, it sounds like this unity has occurred mm-hmm. within you first, as you mm-hmm. brought in both sides, in yourself and in your work. So what compelled you to write this book and not just go out there and do it in your practice?
Oh, the reason why I wrote this book is, number one, I couldn't find a book that was going to show the confluence of Western and Eastern thought. As I said, you see books, many books on happiness, and they pick one or two little areas, and then they run with them. And in some ways, that's a good thing because it presents something very simple and makes something very important accessible. But when you really think about happiness in our whole life, I always felt that there was something missing, of course. I mean, because life cannot be reduced to one or two aspects, even if they are very, very important, like love and compassion and right. happiness and efficacy and feeling that we can do things, like having self-esteem and trust and having competence and all that. These are all very important components. But when we look at our own lives, and the way we live them here in the West, in the modern world, we know that there's more to life. And I felt, really, I had this thirst for something something synthesized, something that would answer more to the whole of my life. So that's a very intellectual kind of, yeah, it's an intellectual quest. I was so dissatisfied with what I found on the market. Yeah. But then there's a very personal reason as well. I don't know if you want to know about my personal
life. I would love to hear about your personal life.
Well,
if you're willing to tell us, Andrea, only if you're willing to tell us.
I'm totally willing to tell you because I think it's a part of the story. And
yeah.
I came from a family where there was a lot of abuse.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered when I was a child growing up if I could be happy. People like me, people who
right.
have suffered a lot, could they be happy? Is that possible? Because I noticed, it wasn't very difficult to notice, that when you are loved, when somebody takes care of you, they teach you skills. They give you something. It's not just a nice feeling, but you get something from the other person when they love you, your parents. They teach you. And I felt, I realized I had an incredible deficit there, and I didn't even know just how big the deficit would be. It had to be there.
Right.
So I was wondering about this question, and I was very afraid. I was not very happy with my doubt that maybe people like me cannot be happy, that it is determined by our circumstance. And so I went on this quest in my life, and I did not leave any stone unturned. I did therapy and different types of therapy and got in touch with my pain and learned how to express it, learned different skills, different ways of being. And meanwhile, I fostered also my quiet side and my stillness with meditation and walking meditation, sitting meditation, and so eventually, and I never forget that moment, I was in Berlin and I walked out of the subway, and it's really ugly. I don't know if you've ever been in Berlin,
yeah.
but it's an ugly sight. It's gray, it's loud, it's shrill, it's not pleasant. So I walked up the stairs and I asked myself a question as I had so many years before. I was 26. And suddenly the answer came to me, not so much in form of words, but I
right.
suddenly realized I was happy then. I was happy. Everything was already done. And nothing had to be acquired. Nothing.
For no reason.
Yeah.
For no reason.
It was for
right.
no, yeah, it was just
yes.
there. Everything was there. And then I had this incredible longing to share that with other people, to how to reduce suffering that doesn't have to be, and how to acquire certain skills that you just need to function in this world, but also how do you get to this point where you can let the present moment fill you up and nourish you completely, and how to remove these obstacles and suddenly realize that it's all there, right there in the moment. And so I wanted to share that. I guess that's kind of my my mission in life, you know, to help abolish suffering wherever I can, and also help people to get to a point where they can invite that guest of happiness.
You know, it's a great story, Andrea, and thank you for sharing it with us. And, you know, I've heard a number of these sorts of stories. It's not dissimilar to mine, although I didn't come from an abusive family, but I had a very similar moment where I've been very unhappy for a long time. And I looked up at one point and realized that I was happy at that moment, and there was no cause. There was no cause whatsoever, but it was simply there. And that was sort of one of the moments that I described in my little intro. But whenever I hear stories like yours, I'm reminded that I've heard a number of them now, especially from writers, that obviously you wouldn't wish what happened to you in your childhood on anyone. But part of what you're doing now is a consequence of that. What you learned by moving from that sense of feeling broken and feeling and wondering if perhaps that was it for you, you know, the damage had been done, it couldn't be undone. Mm-hmm. Moving from that to that moment stepping out of the subway, that became the foundation for your gift to life that you gave back. And without the abuse, it maybe doesn't have the same power. That became your root there. I'm not saying you should wish it on anyone. And yet, that's become a big part of the source of your, of really the meaning of your life, the meaning in your life even.
Yeah, it definitely helped me define my mission. And, it catapulted me. It pushed me into striving, you know, it helped me strive and strive and strive, something that sounds very un-Eastern, by the way, striving and striving and striving. But, you know, I don't know if you're familiar with this, Goethe's Faust, there's a scene, it's a tragedy, a German tragedy, and in the end, the bad hero could be saved by the angels. And the answer was, why? Because he was really rotten in that tragedy.
Right.
He was a very bad person. And so why could he be saved? And the answer was, everyone who strives can be saved. So it sounds very counterintuitive that that has anything to do with Eastern, because in Eastern you want to be. But
right.
In Eastern there is no striving. You are here right now, and this is it. In the present moment, but it's not necessary to strive anywhere. But in a way, it's the kind of striving, you know, that was in my head. That was a deep yearning, a deep longing, and it was more like a Japanese cone, like a question that is in your mind that kept repeating itself, that cannot be answered rationally. I couldn't have like one or two or three insights or in therapy or read some books. It had to be born out of my many, many different ways of living, many different ways of changing habits and stopping bad habits, creating new habits. It had to be born out of this, and it came, the answer came unexpected at an unexpected moment, and it was the answer basically for my intense questioning, you know, without any rationality involved, really.
Yes, well, I've always felt that happiness defies rational thinking in a lot of ways, because it, you know, that old quote from the Bible, you know, God says, I am that I am, and happiness always feels that way. It is that it is.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, for me, when I try to ascribe a reason to it, it disappears. It is for me, it is only there when I attach no reason for it.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, I mean, it's very obvious that, number one, very, very rational people oftentimes are not very, very happy. You know,
yeah.
It's like, I'm a very reasoning person. I love thinking.
Mm-hmm.
I am intellectual. But, you know, the happiness is something that needs to come up spontaneously. It needs to spring up in us. We cannot will ourselves to it. We cannot think ourselves into it. I don't know. I have in the front of my book my favorite little poem, if I may recite it, it says it so well, by William Blake. He who binds to himself a joy does the winged life destroy, but he who kisses the joy as it flies lives in eternity's sunrise. So for me, not hanging on to thought or any formations in my head, not hanging on to any particular emotion, but realizing that everything is here to pass, everything, the good and the bad, that can be good or bad for us, we just don't know. That's just how life is. It can be good or bad in our emotional experience. Everything passes. If we try to hold on in any way, and that's what we, I think, try to do when we are too much into our thinking mind, then we are trying too hard. And as soon as I tell myself to, you don't have to try so hard. You can be in the present moment. Things come, and they come to me. And it's like, for me, happiness is like a butterfly, and we can only be good flowers and make sure that we are good flowers.
Yes.
And attractive flowers. We are all flowers, but the question is, are we open up? And are we sweet flowers? Are we colorful flowers? And then when we are, that's the only thing we can do. The butterfly can come. And so
beautiful image. And it's so perfect, I think, because anyone who's listened to this show has probably heard me say that I've always looked upon the experience of writing, which, of course, is a creative act, and I think that all life is a creative act, so I can't differentiate the experience of writing from just living. I think it's all the same. But for me, when I talk about writing, I always talk about receptivity, about listening, that mostly what I'm practicing is listening. And, you know, interestingly today, Andrea, that we were talking about this, so I was writing something this morning, and it was I'm writing about my own life right now, and I was writing a scene I've been trying to write, and I'd written in a couple drafts, and I'd never quite gotten it the way I'd wanted to. And I sat there for about 20 minutes trying to finish this one paragraph. When I say trying to finish, I mean just sitting there waiting for the perception that I was longing for but I couldn't find. And all I was really doing, Andrea, was trying to let go of the old story I had about that event so I could see the true perception of it, that I was that I was resisting. And of course, for me, anyway, I don't know if you're that way, I'm always resisting the idea that someone else could be right and I could be right. And so I think about that in terms of, I'm sorry about that, I've got someone knocking on my door. I think about that when when I hear you talking about letting things pass and letting things go.
Yeah.
And you have to receive all that, you have to receive your happiness, you know.
Yeah, the receptive state of mind is the beginning, especially when it comes to the Eastern worldview for me, especially when it comes to that type of happy, because I describe happiness as in two very different ways. One is what we just described a lot, that we are finding ways to be open to the stream of life, that it can take us over. So something can take us over that isn't contaminated with our thought, our expectations, and so on, and that we can just be in that, something can carry us away and with it and open us up, and we can then make use of our skills because they will somehow fit the situation. And in the Western way, something else, I think, happens. It's a bit different from the Eastern way in that we are trying to create the flow ourselves instead of homing in the flow that is in life, inherent in life and in our consciousness. So when we concentrate on our consciousness itself, then the stream of life can be experienced, can be noticed and realized. But in the West, there's different ways of describing the flow. Csikszentmihalyi wrote a beautiful book, Flow. And he talked about how when we pursue a particular goal, a defined goal, a very concrete goal, very different from what we were just describing, very concrete goal, and we're saying we want to, let's say, we want to write a book on happiness or so.
Right.
We want to write a book on something that is important to us, or we want to build a garden. We have in our mind a very concrete, a definable goal. We don't know the content of the garden yet, but
right.
we have that particular goal, and then we strive towards that goal. And in the striving, instead of being, bathing in the stream of life, in the striving, in swimming in it, and in applying a lot of skill, we are forgetting about our ego, we're forgetting about ourselves, we're forgetting about the very goal that was so important to us in the beginning of that process. And we are creating a particular flow experience in our consciousness. So it's different from one
it's
another.
It's another route towards that same experience.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. It is still the stream of life, but one is with a goal or with another person as well, because a goal is outside of ourselves that we can define in that mode, or a person, you know, like
sure.
you, for example. I'm talking to you, and you're separate from me. In a way, you're separate. In a more profound way, you're not separated at all. We
That's
are
right.
in a relationship, and we have so much in common. And we are relating to each other. There's something that connects us. But on a different level, you are different from me, and I am making contact to a different person, and I'm reaching out to a different person, a different another. I put it in quotation marks, another. And so, by doing that, if I only see you, I will get frazzled. I become anxious, or afraid, or lose myself. But if I focus on the relationship and our space between us and the relationship, then we are creating also a
That's
flow.
Right. That's
so
right.
It's either a goal or another person. We get lost in the process of striving towards this connection. And it's quite different from the Eastern way, but it's a different access. It's a different access to that stream of life.
I agree completely, because I know that when I've played music and when I write, I use the experience of the practiced experience of writing to enter the flow through that. I've just trained myself how to do it, and how in that experience I've trained myself how not to think about all the things that let my mind operate in the ways that normally prevent me from entering the flow and sort of the busy everyday life. But within the framework, the controlled framework of writing, it's much easier for me. And in conversation, one of the things I love about conversation and other people, and I love the way you described it, but there's something profound about having the thought come to me,
mm-hmm.
formless, inside me, and then me finding the language so I can share it with you, and I can pass this idea over to you. The thing that started as an idea, and then it becomes words, and then I speak it, and now it's between the two of us, and now it can go into you and take shape in there. That is life happening there between us, and your presence, your existence, calls from me something for a specificity that wasn't there before. And that specificity, to me, is part of that stream of life that you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. That's a beautiful description. It's a beautiful description. And when I write, I make that connection with my reader. And I think if we don't do that, you know, if we write only for ourselves and we don't try to make something that's in our head really available and make it a part between me and somebody else, then I think we're writing for ourselves, and it becomes self-indulgent and flat. And when I write, I think of my reader, and I try to listen or read as if I was my reader. What would I experience?
Right.
Is this too heady? Is this too intellectual? Is this something that can touch me? Is that going to open me up when I read it? Is this, you know, so I examine myself and try to let go. I have so many, I don't know if it's,
Andrew, you know, my God, we have about 15 seconds left. I just heard the bug in my ear. Ugh.
It was too wonderful.
It was too wonderful. I could have talked to you all day with Andrea. Thank you so much for coming on the show. The book is
Thank
A
you.
Unified Theory of Happiness. Go out and get it, everybody. In the meantime, be happy. Be there. Be in the flow. You really can't miss it. Oh, Andrea, I'll see you later.
This is wonderful.